Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books and adaptations and more. This is episode number 138. I'm Karen.
I'm Kristen.
And yeah, it's been a while. I was also laughing because up to date, that's a joke.
That's, it's a little up to interpretation, yeah. Whether you're up to date.
I think it's been potentially like
4 weeks, six
4 to 6 weeks. Yeah. I know I released the last episode much later than I meant to. Then we didn't record for a couple of weekends because our schedules just kept missing to each other. Like, we were off in different places and doing different things. So it was a little chaotic.
Yeah. June was kind of a big mess.
Yeah.
Between vacations and my niece was born and just all kinds of random stuff, it kind of just, got out of control. But we're back, so.
Yeah, and I'm in crunch time for my next book that's due, which is, this was like a really fast turnaround because the release dates kind of got, not messed up, but they were like much closer than I was expecting them to be.
Gotcha.
So yeah, I'm a little panicked, but what's new? That's usually how these things go. It'll be fine. But if you guys saw our Instagram, you saw that I was at the Columbus Book Festival.
Yeah.
And it would have been really cool if you could have come, Kristen.
I know. I wanted to. It was just not going to happen.
Yeah. And, well, honestly, might have been for the best. Not because I didn't have a good time, but because I had a good time and also a terrible time.
Yeah.
It was so humid that the sweat would not evaporate off of us. And there was, like, a breeze once every 10 minutes, and it was, like, completely miserable. You got to go inside to the library, and, like, they had AC cranking, and, like, you got to cool down, but the second you stepped outside again, it was just, like, you felt so disgusting. I didn't even want to, like, eat anything, because I was just, like, I'll probably just puke, and, oh, it was awful. There was a ton of people there. And at one point, we were, we went inside because it had started raining, and then we got like a prime seat next to the window, and once it actually started raining, got to see all the people scatter, which was kind of funny. And then we, it like slowed way down, and I swear to God, Kevin looked at the radar and was like, all right, it's done raining. So we went back outside and we walked around for a minute and we were like, this is still kind of miserable. Let's just grab some food and then, like, go. And I had books that we wanted to get signed in my bag, which had a liner, but, like, didn't want it to get too wet. And then all of a sudden, it started downpouring again. And so I ran to an overhang. Oh, back up. We were getting some food, and he's like, crepes. I've never had crepes before. And I was like, they're good. They're, like, little thin pancakes, and you put, like, chocolate and, like, you know, you can have sweet ones, you can have savory ones, and, like, I like them, you should try them. And he was like, okay, I'll try them. So he ordered it, and then it started raining, and it got a little bit heavier and a little bit heavier and a little bit heavier, and he was like, you should probably go find somewhere because we don't want the books to get wet. And I was like, all right, I'm gonna go over there under the overhang where there was, like, a ton of people already, and I'll wait for you. Tell me why he ordered his crepe, and, like, there were people in front of us and people behind us, and people behind us kept getting their food, and he's still waiting there. And they didn't forget him because I don't think he went up to the window and was like, hey, where's my crepe? But, like, he stood there, I'm not joking, in pouring rain for probably 15 minutes. He got over to me. I've never seen this man look so dejected in my life. He comes over, he hands me the food, he takes his t-shirt and wrings it out. Took like 2 to 3 days for his shoes to dry.
Oh, yeah.
It was, he was like, let's just go home. I was like, okay, I'm so sorry. And the worst part about this story is he ate the crepes and he was like, these aren't even that good. And I tried them and I was like, they're really not. I'm so sorry. Aww. So, like, that was, like, definitely an adventure. That was the first day we were, like, at the festival. That was Saturday. And then Sunday, I feel like we did things a little bit better. So we went there because of Matt Dinneman, who writes Dungeon Crawler Carl. He was going to be on a couple of panels, and he was going to be signing books.
Yeah.
And then I also wanted to go because Roseanne A. Brown was going to be there.
Yeah.
And she was going to be on a couple panels, and she was going to be signing books. And I was like, we've talked to her. She's, like, so easy to talk to, very friendly with her, but I've never met her in person. I was like, I got to do this. And he already wanted to go, so I was like, perfect. And I didn't really know or care about, like, anybody else there. It was pretty much those two authors. And so the first day, we were walking toward it, and this woman stopped because she saw that Kevin had on a Dungeon Crawler Carl shirt, and she was like, "You're here for Matt Dinneman?" And he was like, "Yeah." She's like, "There's 1,000 people in line for his panel. They started lining up at like 6 a.m. And we were like, well, that's not happening
right now
because, like, it was miserable outside. And, like, as much as we wanted to see him, it just wasn't worth it.
Mm-hmm.
But on Sunday, we kind of decided to forego the panels because some of them were outside. And a few of them, like, I wanted to see Rosie talk, but, like, it just wasn't happening.
Yeah.
And I was like, ugh, I felt so disgusting. And so we decided to wait in line for Matt Dinneman to sign our books, which we waited 2 hours, which, like, to me is not bad.
Yeah.
For Kevin, he was like, I'm so bored. And I was like, you are not used to Comic-Con or, like, the book Book Expo America that used to be in New York City, which may or may not be coming back,
by
the way. I saw
there's BookCon or something. Yeah.
So I was like, this is nothing. Waiting 2 hours really isn't that bad. And we got our book signed. That was really exciting. Like, it was really great. And he decided he was going to, the whole thing about that was he told the library, there's going to be a lot of people here for me. And apparently they didn't believe him. And his signing on the first day was a mess.
Yeah.
That they actually had to, like, announce a change of schedule for Sunday, and he decided to forego. There was supposed to be this, like, speed dating thing where groups of 5 people would sit down with an author and the author would, like, pitch their book to them, and he was supposed to be doing that, and he canceled that and decided, okay, after my panel I'm just gonna sign the rest of the day, which was really awesome of him.
It is.
And, like, he was standing the whole time and just, like, signing, and he was happy. He had, like, tons of energy. Like, you could tell he really loves, like, doing this.
Yeah.
And so after that, I went downstairs, and I was trying to find the line for Rosie, and I asked, and they were like, okay, so we had to move that line because there's so many people in line.
Love that.
And, yeah, and it was a panel of 3 or 4 authors, and the one author, apparently, like, everybody was there for her, pretty much. Rosie said that they sold out of her first and second book there, I think. So, like, I mean,
that's good news.
Definitely a lot of people got to see her, but this one author, I think on that day, everybody was there for her. And so I got in this massive line, and they were like, we're going to pull out people for the other ones when they're ready. That way we kind of, like, split up the line a little bit. And she was like, okay, who's here for Roseanne A. Brown? And I was like, I am. Me and 2 other people step out of line. And this was, like, right at the beginning, so I'm sure more came later.
Yeah.
But we go over there, the 2 people go up to the line, and I was like, kept checking behind me. Nobody's behind me, nobody's behind me. Perfect, I can talk to her as long as I can. And finally I get up there, and she was like, oh, you have the first Sarawa book. You must have brought it from home because they sold out of them. And I was like, yes, I did. And then I was like, by the way, I'm Karen from Prophecy Radio Podcast. And she was like, oh my God, Karen! And immediately stood up and hugged me. And we just chit-chatted for, like, 5 to 10 minutes. And it was great. I mean, she is, like, exactly what you would hope for an author to be, like. Just, like, a nice person who's, like, a huge fan of things. I mean, we know she loves Percy Jackson. And she was just so nice. She, like, specifically, I didn't even bring it up, you guys. She's like, if you ever need somebody else on the podcast, let me know. And I was like, we will definitely have you on again because she's a huge fan of Percy Jackson, and it's just really fun to talk to her about it.
Absolutely.
So I got my book signed, and I got a picture with her, which I really love that picture.
It's a good picture.
Yeah, we look cute.
Yeah.
And that's up on our Instagram if you guys want to see it. And yeah, that was very exciting. I was so, so happy to meet her. I wish, like, you know, I could have had more time to talk to her because she's just so easy to talk to. But at that point, too, like, that was later in the day, and I was kind of getting exhausted. And I think we went home after that. Like, we walked around for a little bit. And I got some, I may or may not have gotten some spicy romance book stickers.
Nice.
And yeah. but that was pretty much it. But we did have a good time in Columbus, and he's got a couple cousins and a friend who lives there, so we had people to hang out with and stuff. And that's overall, cool. We accomplished what we wanted to accomplish. We just took a while to get there in the end, but it was really great. And maybe next year, if we want to go, the weather will be better. Because that was really the biggest hurdle.
Right, yeah. No, as much as I love the Columbus Public Library system and all of that, they, A, need to believe authors when they tell them things.
Yeah.
Because when Rebecca's event was with the Columbus Library, like, it was through them, and they double-sold her tickets, which meant she couldn't do the signing, which then she still felt like, I don't want to just forego meeting everyone because they all bought tickets. I mean, I think they were free or they were really cheap.
Oh, okay.
But it was like, they bought tickets to this, like, to see me. Like, the whole reason these people want to come to this thing is to, like, have a quick meet and greet and, like, you know, all of that. So, they ended up, she did a whole bunch of book plates.
Mm.
She signed a whole bunch of book plates ahead of time. You were allowed to take, you know, a couple or as many as you wanted, really.
Okay.
And then she did a photo with everyone.
Oh,
so, like, rather than her stopping to sign everyone, you got in line. You could greet her. She had, because of her, Ehlers-Danlos, yes.
Yeah.
In addition to that, she also has POTS.
Oh, okay.
Because of Ehlers-Danlos, like, it all kind of works together. Rough. And so she can't always sign everything. Like, she can't sign for 6 hours or something.
Yeah.
So that's why they pivoted to the other. And so, yeah, like, it ended up being a great event. I was glad I went. I was glad, you know, the whole thing. But, like, yeah, Columbus, we love you. Trust authors when they tell you something. When Matt Dinneman tells you that this is going to be a total hellscape, believe him.
Yeah, seriously.
Like,
his books are just getting bigger and bigger.
Huge.
So,
keep seeing more and more and more of him. Like, just more and more of those covers pop out at me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Barnes & Noble has a whole table devoted to him now.
That's awesome.
At the one out near the mall near us. They had a whole table devoted to him last time I was in there. They had him on the back, like, behind the register.
Mm.
They had a bunch of them, like, on the shelves behind the register, too. So, like, yeah, Matt Dinneman is just, like, you know, growing and growing and growing in his popularity. So, like, yeah, I kind of figured that might end up being a harder one to get into this weekend, or that weekend, than yeah. But I heard a lot of people saying that it was, the weather was an extremely tough thing to get over at the festival.
It was so bad. Like, I at one point I accidentally brushed against Kevin and I just came away, like, soaking wet, and I was like, I love you so much, but this is disgusting.
Do not touch
but
me.
Like, also, I was also, like, super sweaty and gross and, like,
yeah. That was most of the complaints. Like, most people said, like, it's a fabulous event and I love that it's free and that you can just walk right in.
And the library is beautiful. It is so big and they have so much stuff there. We had to line up in between the stacks for a signing. And I was like, look at all these books. There were so many interesting titles, especially, like, when you got to the historic stuff. And, like, oh, it was really cool.
Yeah, like, they do a good job, and it's a great event, especially for a free event, because, you know, how many of those really exist anymore? And I love that about the event and everything, and they get such great authors. It's just, because it's free, it's always packed, and, like, with the weather being as bad as it was, having all those tents out at the park is just, I'm sure, was awful.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you got to go. I'm glad you got to meet Rosie especially.
Yes.
That was really,
I was
really
also
cool.
Excited about Matt Dinneman because Kevin's made me listen to, like, the audiobook.
Yeah.
I'm on the last one that's out right now, which is really exciting. And, like, just so you guys know, they're turning that into a TV show. It's being produced by Seth MacFarlane's company. And the guy who wrote The Mandalorian and Thor Ragnarok is going to be writing the series.
Nice.
So, like, a lot of people didn't want it to be live action, which I totally understand because this series is bonkers. but I'm still looking forward to it.
Yeah.
So, super excited about that. So, yeah, that's why we've taken so long to record that and about 10 million other things.
Right.
But hopefully you guys missed us a little bit. Hopefully you didn't forget about us, because we definitely didn't forget about you. I was checking the Instagram whenever I could. And if you would like to get into contact with us to talk about Percy Jackson, Dungeon Crawler Carl, Roseanne A. Brown, you know, book festivals, humidity, you can do so at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Instagram, or email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. We're really hoping to, going forward, hopefully be a little more consistent. I think, for the most part, I don't have anything major planned for a couple more months, so hoping we'll get a couple more episodes out
here. Yeah. I don't think I have anything major. Maybe some minor, but nothing major.
Yeah.
So it should be fine. We'll be fine. We got this.
but for now, we're going to give you just a quick snapshot of some news and updates that we've come across.
Yeah. So yeah, Karen was nice enough to give me a list of a couple of Instagram posts that we should definitely point out, and I will link to them in the show notes so you guys can get to them very easily. The first is from Percy Jackson on Stage. We now have a UK tour for the stage musical, which is so fun. I mean, we've both seen it, right? Do we see it together?
Yeah.
We saw it together.
Yeah.
Yeah, up in Detroit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's such a good musical. It's so much fun. I'm really excited for the UK to get a chance to see this, not just on, like, the West End or something, but it's going to be on tour, so that is awesome. Let's see. It begin up and down the country from August 15th is the start of this. So if you have not had a chance to check out tickets for that, I highly recommend it. Again, the link will be in our show notes. Moving right along. Just a few weeks ago, while we were running about doing things, the Lightning Thief turned 20. That seemed significant.
Yeah, that's
something we should probably mark.
Yeah, that's pretty big deal.
We like to celebrate anniversaries around here.
We do.
But yeah, that's huge. It's so crazy, like, with all the anniversaries of stuff, like, you know, you feel yourself getting older. You know these things. But, like, watching things like Percy become 20 years old. Like, Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief has now been in the world for 20 years. And it hasn't lost its luster.
Yeah.
Like, there's new families are reading these books with their kids. And new kids are experiencing, you know, these characters and falling in love with Rick and the show. And it's just really, it goes to show that when you have something that's really, that has a touchstone, that everyone can meet you there, even 20 years later. The books
yeah.
are still relevant and interesting. So.
Yeah, I love that.
Especially as we've seen other, like, really popular series kind of fade.
Yeah.
Like, I don't hear about Divergent very much. If it wasn't for
that
the new...
That was my first thought, too.
If it wasn't for the new Hunger Games books, I feel like that one kind of fell off, too.
Yeah.
Even though it's a great series, you just kind of lose track of it after a while.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, there's so many series that you love when they come out, and then you read them, and they just fade, and Percy really hasn't, and that
yeah.
is just worth noting the 20 years there. Okay, we will probably be doing a very news-heavy episode coming up, because Percy Jackson, the cast, is going to be doing a panel at Comic-Con, which is this coming week. When you guys hear this episode, the Comic-Con will have started, because
yeah.
I believe it starts on Wednesday, and I'm hoping to have this up on Wednesday for you guys. So yeah, you guys will You can feel free to keep an eye on Comic-Con news all weekend, because we definitely will be. And our next episode will be a quick rundown of everything we learned from Comic-Con. I'm hoping for a trailer. I'm hoping for, you know, maybe some new casting news or some fun, you know, there's always good fun to be had at Comic-Con. So hopefully they will deliver some fun new things. But for those that want to mark it so that they don't miss the Percy Jackson crew, the cast panel is on Thursday, July 24th. It's in Hall H if you're going to Comic-Con. And so I'm sure there's always live feeds for that sort of thing. I don't know where those live feeds are quite yet, but they do usually pop up closer to Comic-Con. So keep an eye out for that if you are interested. And then, I don't know if anyone else noticed these GIFs on the Percy series account. There's definitely some season 2 Percy Jackson GIFs that were a little shocking to us. We don't know. They kind of were posted with no context. We don't know where they came from or why they were posted. But if you want a quick sneak peek at some of the moments coming up, they definitely highlight some interesting moments.
Yeah, my guess is that they're probably from the trailer, and the trailer's probably going to be released during Comic-Con. But Percy Series just posted it, and, like, I thought it was from something. I thought I missed an actual trailer, and I was, like, scrolling through accounts and looking on the internet, and, like, I couldn't find anything. I didn't dig that deep, so if anybody knows where they came from, please shoot us a link, but otherwise, I kind of just have a feeling they're, like, a teaser for the teaser trailer that's probably going to drop during Comic-Con.
Yeah, because all they said was, who cheered? Percy Jackson and the Olympians Season 2 is coming soon to Disney+, thank the gods. Like, that's all they said when they posted these, so... Yeah, not a whole lot of context there.
Now that you read that, I think I remember seeing that Disney Plus, I think, posted a, like, what's coming, and it might have been from that, like, a quick teaser video, but I couldn't find that video, which is why I was having trouble. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, so
it's probably out there somewhere. I just don't know where.
Yep. Lots to look forward to, though, and yeah, we'll probably do, when all the Comic-Con stuff is said and done, if we've got enough info, we'll do kind of a news heavy up and make sure we hit on all the high points. So.
Yeah.
Okay, and last but not least, Mark Ruffalo and Rick Riordan will be hitting the road for The Court of the Dead, and they are going on tour. You can see, I will link to it in the show notes, there's a lovely little graphic with all of the stops they will be making. The tour begins, it looks like, September 23rd in Boston, and continues through October 1st in California. So it looks like they're hitting Boston, Virginia, Texas, let's see, New Jersey, Georgia, Colorado, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and then California. So it's like one stop in each. It's a good cross-section of states they're hitting.
I was going to say, maybe not so much out west, but like a good middle to the east part of the state.
And I mean, Colorado, Texas, and California, it's a pretty good showing for out west.
Yeah.
Especially because Rick is, you know, East Coast based. Like, it's harder, I think, for him to spend a lot of time on the West Coast. So, yeah. But, yeah, I will link to that as well, so you guys will have access to that in case you are looking to get tickets for that. Okay, now that should be wrapping up our news for today, and we will get more to you as soon as we have it, I promise.
Yes, I'm very excited to find out what's coming and what new stuff we get to see.
So much same.
Yeah,
cool. I can't wait for that trailer.
I'm itching for that rewatch soon. We gotta do that.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right, well, let's jump back into the Red Pyramid. Today we are discussing chapters 31 and 32, and I decided to write a very, very mini recap because I was having a little trouble remembering what happened in the last two chapters. But basically, Zia wants to meet up somewhere and said not to trust Amos. And then Bast, remember, makes the ultimate sacrifice for the kids. And then who shows up but Amos? And he's offering a helping hand. And the kids are like, Well, Carter's like, because Sadie's unconscious.
I was going to say, yeah.
They fought some crocodiles. And, yeah, it did not really go all that well for them.
Mm.
So chapter 31, I deliver a love note. We are back in Sadie's point of view now. And she is very glad that Carter took the last two chapters because she cannot think about Bass' sacrifice because she keeps crying about it. And that, like, I feel like for Sadie to admit that is kind of a big deal. Like, she's not necessarily a super, like, emotional person.
Yeah.
And to admit that she cares about somebody as much as she cares about Bast, I think, really is very telling. And so she kind of wakes up and Khufu's cooking dinner with his butt in her face while Amos is attending to Sadie, and Carter is holding Muffin in his lap. He's kind of sitting off to the side. And this is Muffin Muffin. This is the cat without the goddess inside of it, Muffin. I thought Amos's description was really funny because it says he looked how he normally looked. Blue suit and matching coat and fedora, long hair in braids, and round glasses. And I do not remember him looking like this because I always picture him a bit more like feral looking, almost like, I don't want to say a homeless person, but like...
kind of like a dotty old man.
Not even dotty, more like living on the streets. But, like, by choice, kind of.
Okay.
And so the fact that he's wearing a fedora that matches his suit and coat just really made me laugh. We also find out what happened after Amos left Brooklyn. He was captured by Set. Set, he says, does not need a human host as long as he has the pyramid. So that is a very interesting piece of information that... to be honest, I'm not 100% sure I believe, but...
I was going to say, unfortunately, Amos is a bit of an unreliable narrator right now, because we don't know whether we can trust him, we don't know whether he's telling us the truth, or, you know, so we can hear this and use it, but also remember that, like, that might not be entirely accurate.
Right, and I love that the kids kind of also are aware of that. They're not just trusting him at face value. But it is a little bit sad what he says happened to him, because he said that Set stationed Amos outside the pyramid like a trophy so the demons could laugh at him, which was kind of hilarious. Like, you could tell that this is a middle grade book, because that's like the worst thing Set could do to him was like set him out there so the demons could laugh at him.
Like string him up the flagpole kind of thing, you know, like tied to the flagpole kind of thing. Like, yeah.
We also learn that Osiris's coffin is inside the pyramid, and when Set unleashes his storm, it will explode and Osiris and Julius will be obliterated, which obviously means death for Julius.
Mm-hmm.
And for Osiris, he says, Osiris will be exiled so deep into the Duat, he may never rise again. So that's kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
For, like... such an important figure in the Egyptian pantheon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sucks for their dad, too.
Definitely.
Lucky for Amos, though, he escaped during midday when the demons were all asleep. And at least I think he's willing to admit that he believes Set let him go and that this is a trick.
Yeah.
But do we know what Set's ulterior motive could possibly be?
It's a bit, like, it's almost reading a bit like a secret agent mm-hmm. who's secretly working not just for the secret agency, but the secret agency's enemy, but then he's also secretly working for the agency he loves, but he's pretend, you know, it's like a triple cross, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it feels like Amos is Amos, working toward Amos's goals, and then Amos is captured by Set, and now he's under Set's... not control, but, like, influence.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't necessarily know that what he's telling us is true because Set told it to him. And so then Amos is aware that Set might be messing with him, but still trusts the information enough to use it and, like, to function by it. Mm-hmm. So it's, like, yeah, it's really, really hard to kind of wrap your head around, like, whether or not... we do not know who Amos is truly serving right now, and I don't know when we will. Like, I don't know when what is going to be
right.
enough to prove to us that Amos is looking out for the kids first and foremost, or is a servant of Set and has no, you know, agency to make decisions for himself, or, you know, whatever. Yeah, I don't know what Set might like, why go to all of this trouble if you're this powerful? Like, mm-hmm. he's got the perfect, you know, setup right here. He doesn't need a human to embody, so he doesn't need the kids for that. And, you know, he's got this power that as soon as the time is right, like, he'll be able to obliterate Osiris. And if Osiris is gone, that's going to weaken the other gods. So, like, what could he possibly, what motive could he have for sending Amos to them with lies or with information that's going to hurt that? Like, I'm not sure.
I don't think that they said this, but my guess would be, like, I don't know if we know whether Set can, like, leave the pyramid or not. Like, is he tied to the pyramid because, like, his, like, power is tied to the pyramid? So he might not be able to travel. So by abducting Amos and, like, I don't know, possessing him or, like, having somebody else possess him or something, is that, like, a way for him to find out what the kids are doing? Because he can't physically, like, spy on them unless they're, like, sleeping, and then he can kind of get a look into their head or whatever, but...
That's a good note, yeah. That would be... That would be motivation, is...
Yeah.
He's trying to figure out where they are, what they know, what they're working with. Because I assume there is a way to stop him, but unless they have a lead on it or know how, they're not a threat. You know, like, if they have no idea how to stop him, then they're not a threat to him. So he would need to know that info.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we'll just have to wait and see, but right now they're in White Sands, New Mexico, which is a government range for testing missiles. No one will look for them there because, yeah, why would you? And they have officially 12 hours until Set, you know, which was a very ominous way to word that.
Definitely.
But I can understand not really wanting to think about it. Sadie remembers her conversation before she went unconscious with Nephthys, who said she was sheltered far away in a sleeping host. So, I feel like we don't know who the sleeping host could be,
mm-hmm.
because we don't know anybody who's sleeping.
We don't know anybody who's sheltered far, far away from us that's sleeping.
Yeah. So, I have a guess that I'm not going to say, in case it's in there somewhere for other reasons, but...
I mean, I will go ahead and say the only thing that occurs to me at the moment would be their mother.
Right. Who is supposedly dead.
Supposedly dead.
Mm-hmm.
But the last they saw of her, she was... I'm trying to remember. It's been a while. It had something to do with the obelisk, right? In London?
Mm. Oh, that was where she died.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm trying to remember, like, what... that's okay. There's always that, especially in books like these, there's always that chance that she died, but, like, they brought her back, or
right.
she hadn't entirely crossed over, and so they were able to link her to Nephthys, and so therefore their mom isn't... You know, she's in a twilight sleep kind of state.
Right.
And that would... definitely lead you to think that could be who that is, especially because, yeah, there aren't really a plethora of characters floating around. It's not like this is Percy Jackson book number 7 where you've got this whole history of characters that
right.
it could be. Like, this is the first book in this series, so we don't know everyone behind the scenes. You know, we don't have a whole catalog of characters back there. So, yeah, that would be my first instinct, unless
yeah.
it's a character we just haven't met yet.
Which is also possible.
Yeah.
Rick is pretty tricky, so we'll see what happens. But Sadie, at this point in the story, learns the details about Bast's sacrifice, and Amos says that he doesn't think she'll be back for a few hundred years, which is super, super sad. And Sadie, you know, speaking of sad, this, I didn't actually cry, but it did, like, make me feel very emotional and empathetic to Sadie. She says she lost her home, her ordinary life, her parents, her cat. She's almost been killed half a dozen times. And she says, what haven't I sacrificed already? And this is in reference to Anubis asking her, like, what are you willing to sacrifice? And she's like, I have nothing left to sacrifice except maybe her brother,
mm-hmm.
Which would be terrible.
Yes.
But, yeah, I mean, it's so sad to realize what these kids have been through in such a short amount of time and how tremendously their lives have changed already.
Well, and it's like, you know, you think about these Greek and Egyptian mythological stories, and they're always talking about, like, you know, you must sacrifice to for the balance or for this or that. And, it's, you know, looking at how Sadie feels right now and everything she's lost that she can't get back. And, you know, some a character like Anubis asking her, what are you willing to sacrifice? Well, it's like, nothing. I'm willing to sacrifice nothing.
Yeah.
And you kind of think back to all those mythological figures and you're like, this is probably how they felt too. You know, you've lost your home or your family or everything. And then some god says, well, I need a sacrifice. And it's like, well, you can screw off because I don't care that you want me to sacrifice something. I have nothing left to give you.
Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of drilled home that, like, she's been asked to give up a lot and to sacrifice a lot just to get to where they are now. And who knows what lies ahead, you know? It's like, these stories often ask for a lot of sacrifices. And, yeah, Sadie's, she's done. She's mm-hmm. given up enough. The only thing she really has left is her brother, and I don't see her giving him up anytime soon, so.
Yeah, I think that would really be the last straw for her.
For her sanity and for her.
Yeah. So she eats some of Khufu's terrible soup, stew, something bad, and immediately falls asleep, and her soul leaves her body. Luckily for her, she stays in her human form, not the turkey form, and she grows as tall as the Washington Monument. One of my favorite lines that I almost picked for this chapter was, I've been told many times that I have a lot of spirit, usually not as a compliment, but this was absurd. And I just can see her saying that. It just makes me laugh.
I love how she kept commenting, like, I really don't want to step on us.
Yeah.
Like, she kept, like, looking down at Amos and Carter and, like, I really hope I don't step on anyone.
Yeah.
Like, she was that big.
But the reason why she's this big is because she's about to meet Geb, the earth god, who's basically just a giant sandy man. He's a man made out of sand.
I couldn't help but picture Tafiti from Moana, like, laying down as the island.
Yes.
And just, like, sitting up, only envisioning, like, a desert and sand.
That was my first...
Just, like, a sand guy.
Yeah, that was my first thought, too. And then I kept thinking Sandy Claus from The Nightmare Before Christmas, and that made me giggle.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing Sadie does is give Geb Nut's note. Ooh, that was a little bit of a tongue twister. Which kind of explodes into fireworks and puts a constellation of her face into the sky, but then a gust of wind comes through and kind of, like, breaks it all apart. And essentially, he hadn't seen her face in a very long time, so, like, that was
the true gift.
Yeah. And he puts the envelope inside his sandy chest as if there were a pocket right where his heart should be. Look, I know I read a lot of romance, but this was, like, so beautiful. And, like, there were a couple other moments where I was like, Rick really has, like, the right touch for those, like, tiny moments that end up meaning a lot. And, like,
tuck this little thing real close to my heart.
Yeah. Oh, it was so cute.
Yeah. That was a really cute moment.
Yeah. Geb is very thankful and grants her a favor. She immediately asks for him to save her father, but he can't since Julius's path is twined with Osiris's. And he says, matters between the gods cannot be solved by the earth, which I thought was a very, like, profound line. It was, I really liked that. She then asks if he can collapse the pyramid, but he can't. He can't intervene so directly between his children because Set is his son too. And so she's kind of getting pretty frustrated at this point. And so he offers her some advice. Go to the place of the crosses. She will find danger and she will find what she needs most. But of course he doesn't tell her exactly where because what's the fun in that?
Yep.
And then he says he loves all of his children, even Set. And says Set is more than he appears. He is our flesh and blood. And Sadie says, not mine. And Geb just goes, no. very cryptically.
Yeah.
He's super cryptic and vague because he's a god that's, like, in their bylaws or something.
Yeah.
But this scene was really interesting to me because I feel like... I'll talk about this more in a minute, but, like, Geb was maybe one of the better gods that we've met. Like, he wasn't really over the top. I felt like he wanted to help, and he, like, did as much as he could. And, yeah, Sadie technically did him a favor first by delivering the note, but, like, he seemed genuine about wanting to, like, point her in the right direction, and I really liked that.
Like, yes, he delivered the same parting lines we hear from the gods so often, which is, I can't interfere, I can't help, but, like, this felt more like, not just, I'm not willing to help, mm-hmm. it's like, this would cause more trouble than it's worth. Like,
yeah.
If the Earth gets involved in these kinds of things, it complicates matters, and you don't want that. And I am not choosing between my children. That's going to start a whole nother war that we don't need. You know,
yeah.
Like, that's more or less what he's getting at here, is not like, oh, I'm choosing not to help you because I'm, you know, moody and a total wench. Like, so many of the Greek gods, it's like, I don't feel like helping you, so I'm not going to, ha ha ha, and they run away.
Yeah.
Geb definitely gives you the, I am wiser than you know, and
yeah.
I'm telling you I can't do this and I won't do this, trust me, but you should go here and do this thing, and I think it will help you. And so it's hard not to believe that he at least has their best interest at heart. Like, he is trying to help, and this is the best way he knows how.
Yeah. I think this is a really good transition into our favorite moments, actually, because this was my favorite moment, meeting Geb, and there was something just so different about him, and I feel like there's something very different about the Egyptian gods, too, because the Greek gods very much feel like caricatures, and, like, I love that for them. I love how ridiculous it is. But, like, this series so far, even though we've met some gods that are kind of ridiculous, they feel older, they feel a little more dangerous, they feel like not so much we're meant to, like, laugh at them. And to me, like, I feel like they're more, like, primordial. They're more archetypal, where it's this, like, representation of a bigger idea. And I think the Greek gods get some of that sometimes, but I feel like Rick intentionally made the Greek gods very silly, and I think he's intentionally made the Egyptian gods a little less so.
I will go a step further. I think you're absolutely right. I'll go a step further. I think when it comes to gods, especially in both pantheons that you are super familiar with, he's really willing to make them silly.
Mm.
Like, if you think about, like, Zeus, Hera, Ares, Hades, like, they all have a bit of that, like, superficial, like, silliness to them. But when you think to, like, some of the Greek gods that are bigger, like, when you think of Gaia, when you think of even, like, Hecate, or, like, Nyx, they're more ethereal, almost.
Yeah.
Like, they have less of a, I am human-like, and I have human-like, you know,
right.
mood swings, and I am this. They
yeah.
are these, like, presences that as soon as you're near them, you feel that power. It's almost like Kronos, too. Like, he had an agenda, but, like, he was bigger than just, like, Hades, who's, running around doing what Hades wants for Hades' sake, and he's constantly, you know, up in Zeus's face about this, that, or the other thing. Like, they almost feel like bickering siblings, which is what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got these other gods that, like, have been around for so long that they just feel otherworldly. And I feel like that's the Egyptian gods as a whole have more of that presence. It feels older, it feels more ancient, it feels more like just they've seen so much that they cannot be bothered with all this little trifly, you know, stuff that's going on in the world.
I absolutely agree with you, and I think there's something simmering in my brain about, like, the main pantheon of Greek gods, Zeus, Hera, all of them, I think were meant to be kind of relatable. They
yeah.
were meant to be, like, people, yes, like, people bigger than us with powers and stuff like that, but, like, they had lots of flaws. Like, that was kind of how the Greeks related to them and everything. And I was trying to think of, like, all the Greek gods that you mentioned that kind of were a little bit outside of that. I was like, what do they all have in common? And to me, like, a lot of them were, like, the Titans, or a lot of them were, like, the more primordial gods. Like, Nyx is night, you know?
Like, elemental, almost.
Yeah, that was exactly the word I was going to use. And they all represent ideas much bigger than, okay, I'm Zeus, god of lightning,
yeah.
You know? And instead it's like, okay, this is, like, chaos incarnate, or, like, this is the entire sky, which is, like, a much bigger concept than just, like, you know, the blue that you see when you look up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the Greek gods, not that they weren't, maybe they were less, like, personable. I don't know enough about them to, like, be able to say that one way or another. But to me, they feel more like that. Like, this concept of, okay, Osiris, like, and even Anubis, they're tied to death, and death is, like, such a big concept for the Egyptians that it's a bigger thing than just Hades being in charge of the underworld.
Right. It's not like they're in charge of the underworld. They are the gods of that transition. Like, they're helping you figure out where you're going after death. And, like, it's not just, oh, I had to figure out how to organize souls in the underworld, so this is how I did it. These are the places you can go. This is how you get there. Like, it's very ethereal. You're looking at the concept of death and experiencing it differently with the Egyptian gods.
Right. And I just think their whole presence is, like, weightier in a lot of ways than, like, some of the Greek ones. Whether that's true in general or whether that's just true of Rick's books, I'm not sure, but...
Well, and we've noticed with the Egyptian gods a lot, they cross over quite a bit, where it's like, oh, he's god of death, but then this god also has some, you know, some contact with, like, the idea of death. They also kind of, you know, govern this section of it, you know. So it's like, because the Egyptian gods are kind of more amorphous and, like...
Yeah,
they kind of cover more, and so therefore they overlap more. So you have different gods that all kind of have the same... Like, it's not even, like, the same power, because it's not a power. It's, like, this is the area of life that they kind of have taken on as their section, you know, whatever. Yeah. It's when you get to, like, ideas more than, like... Zeus, god of thunder.
Right.
Like, it's, you know, like, when you get to these gods that are more looking at the grander scheme of things, it gets harder to pinpoint it, but yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So what was your favorite moment?
Mine was Amos relaying his escape from Set, and it was basically commenting on Amos telling them all of what happened, almost as if he isn't bad, but then because we heard from Zia that we shouldn't trust him, something is up, and, like, he seems to question whether he's being used or not, but he doesn't seem to be clear about that. Like, I liked that even Amos was kind of aware that he might not know that he's playing double agent.
Yeah.
And do I trust him yet? No. Do I trust that even that he's even in his right mind right now and is in control? No, I don't. We don't know. So I just really liked that he was kind of self-aware in that moment. And I don't know if he's expecting them to believe everything he's saying either. And that it just made it more approachable for me. It was like, I'm glad that he didn't pop back up in their lives and is like, trust me, follow me, I am the way. Like, no, you're not. We've learned a lot in the last... You know, 10 chapters, 20 chapters.
Yeah, I think it makes the situation a lot more complex and a lot more interesting for us as readers.
Definitely.
So, favorite lines. Clearly, we both really enjoyed Sadie in her Ba form.
Mm-hmm.
Mine was, as she's sort of, like, growing and stuff, she goes, and just when I thought I had this soul leaving the body business sorted, my soul decided to break the rules. Well, it is my soul, after all, so I suppose that makes sense. And it's just like, yeah, that's what Sadie's like.
Yeah, and mine is Sadie in her Ba form talking to Geb, and he's talking about how... these favors that he wishes he could do, he can't because of it's his child. And and she goes, well, your favors aren't very useful then. And it just
sassy.
Felt very seedy.
Yeah. Can you imagine if she said that to a Greek god? Like, they would probably smite her on the spot.
I was gonna say, depending on the god, it could... It very different results.
Yeah.
I mean, if you said something like that to Hera...
Oh,
like,
you're gone. You're gone.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so let's jump into chapter 32, The Place of Crosses. Sadie wakes up with Muffin on her head... And when she gets up, Muffin meows in protest and then steals her spot. And I'm just saying, this was so real of Rick, because if you've ever owned a cat, that is exactly what they do.
Yep.
Like, Callie will be laying on my lap and I'll be like, all right, it's time to get up now. I have to go pee or like go get something to eat or go work or something. And I'll get up. And even if I'm intending to like come back and sit back down in 30 seconds, she's sitting where I was just sitting.
Yep. She wants all the body heat.
Yeah.
She wants it from you. And then when you leave, she wants to steal what you left back.
Yeah. And I mean, it is really cute if you think about it because she loves me.
Mm.
But also, I was sitting there. Rude.
And I got stuff to do. So.
Yeah. So Khufu will take Muffin back to Brooklyn so that they're both safe because they really don't want anything to happen to Muffin, the actual cat.
Why do I feel like this is Rick being like, we are not pulling a John Wick here? Muffin is safe.
Yeah.
Like, Muffin is gone. Sadie's not going to lose her mind because poor Muffin got involved in this, in this battle. He's like, we are removing Muffin from the situation. Muffin is fine.
Yeah.
I just thought it was really funny that it was like... Rick being like, we are not going to have animal death in this book. Like,
yeah.
Let's move on from that.
I also think it makes sense, too, because, like, having an actual cat around all of this chaos, like, was never going to work. The cat would run away. 100%. So.
Yes.
Khufu will take Muffin. I almost just... So their ship name apparently is Mufu, because that's what I almost just said. Their best friends forever ship name
clearly is
Mufu. And... Sadie worries that this is part of the trick. Khufu leaving with Muffin, she's like, I don't know how I feel about this, but don't really have another choice. And we also learn that baboons have their own brand of magic. He can travel back to Brooklyn, no problem. And we also learn that Philip of Macedonia, the crocodile that helped save them, is a Shapti. He's made of clay. So that was really interesting. I forgot... Clearly, because I was like, oh, wow. Like, I thought he was a real crocodile.
Right.
He's not.
An albino crocodile. They exist.
Yeah.
You know. I also thought it was funny that I think it, when Khufu, like, actually leaves, Sadie, like, looks over the dune to see where how far they've gotten, and Khufu's gone. Like, it shows that, like, baboon magic is different, and...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're on well on their way back to New York.
I also love that Khufu, like... purred a little when he came over to come get Muffin, and I just want them to be best friends now. Just gotta be some fan art of the two of them, like, cuddling.
Right.
I feel like that would be so cute.
Yeah.
So Amos wants to know the plan. And Sadie and Carter silently decide it's not safe to tell him, and he reluctantly agrees that he can't trust himself, which we've kind of already talked about. I think it's in this scene, actually, that they mention, like, he could be, like, a listening device for Seth.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
makes a ton of sense. And I loved that he didn't push it. Like, he understood where they were coming from with that.
It makes you think that this is Amos. Like,
right.
It's not Set in Amos's body saying, oh, Set can't travel, he can't inhabit a body. Like, it's actually, you know, it makes you believe that this is Amos because...
Or is Set so tricky?
That he's triple-crossing us,
yeah.
But, like, it makes you think, like, okay... At least he's being realistic, and he's accepting that it's not that they don't trust him, but they have no idea where he's been, what he's been through, really. So, like, yeah.
Yeah. Sadie actually wishes Amos wasn't there so she could talk freely with her brother, and then gets super weirded out by that because she was like, since when do I want to just confide in my brother? This is so weird. But I love that for her. She's really growing a lot emotionally.
Definitely.
Carter suggests they go to Las Cruces because of the vision from Zia, and Sadie realizes that's where Geb told her to go. It's Spanish for the crosses, so that's perfect. They get in their flying boat, which is totally fine, won't cause a stir, because people in New Mexico are used to seeing UFOs all the time.
Done.
Love that explanation.
Roswell, totally, they're just used to it. It's
yeah,
fine.
It's great.
Well, isn't it usually blamed on, like the government, like, missile testing area that they're currently in is, like, a lot of people blame UFOs and stuff on stuff the government's testing.
Yeah.
So, like, they just pay no attention.
Yeah, it's fine. So, they land in the historic part of Las Cruces called Mesilla, and Amos says a line that, to me, felt very much like Rick talking directly to us, which I feel like he does every once in a while in his books, and I kind of love picking them out.
Mm-hmm.
Amos says, the ancient cultures of Mexico have a lot in common with Egypt, but that's a talk for another day. And that felt very much like, to me, all the readers always asking, Rick, when are you going to write about this culture? When are you going to write about this mythology? And I want to say, like, Aztecs, Mayans, like, that was always one of the big ones that people kept requesting. And I also love that he was like, but that's a talk for another day, because, like, that isn't really his wheelhouse. But then also we have Rick Rodden Presents now, and, like, we got to have that conversation with other authors, and it just made me really happy, and I liked it.
I also feel like this is, like, teacher Rick being like, they have a lot in common.
Yeah.
And I would like to talk about that sometime, but we...
Write an essay with 3 to 5 points.
How do they relate to each other?
Yeah.
Like almost like, in doing his research for writing a book about Egyptian gods, he experienced a lot of things and was like, this is reminding me a lot of what I learned as a kid about, you know, Aztec or Mayan, you know, culture and all of that. Like, I can see how diving into one very desert-centric culture can lead you to look at other ones.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
And, like, oh, these do relate. Yeah. So I feel like this is a little bit Teacher Rick. Yeah. It gives me Teacher Rick vibes.
I love that so much. They take some time to eat some yummy food, and let me tell you, I was hungry when I was reading this, and I was like, lunchtime. And Sadie thinks she sees Anubis in the crowd and gets stupid excited for a second, which was so cute. But then she actually spots Zia, who looks ready for battle. And when they meet up with Zia, she is adamant that Desjardins is... she's adamant that Desjardins would never help Set, but implies Amos might be. And also, and then, unfortunately, he shows up with a bunch of other magicians.
But of course.
Yeah. So, obviously, they think right away that Zia set them up. So, before you read further, were you like, oh, Zia set them up? Or did you believe she probably didn't have anything to do with it?
I want to believe that Zia didn't set them up. I want to believe that she trusted Mel that was with her, and that she truly believed she had gotten away from them, because I feel like Zia, she's not a Desjardins disciple. Like, she has her own mind and definitely thought more like her mentor. Like, I can't remember his name.
Iskandar.
Right. Iskandar, yeah, thank you. She definitely kind of seemed to have more in common with Iskandar than she ever did Desjardins. So, like, I know she serves the House of Life, but, like, I don't necessarily feel like she's setting them up here. Does it look bad? Absolutely.
Yeah.
She shows up and then poof, all of a sudden they're all there and it's big trouble and
And it does look really bad. And so Amos blasts her in the chest, knocks her right off her feet, thinking that she set them up. And like you said, she says that it was Mel. And I do believe her, especially given the end of the chapter. But I think in the moment, like, I wanted to think the best of her. And Desjardins still wants them dead, FYI. He has not changed his mind. I don't think either of us thought he was going to.
Mm-hmm.
But Zia actually stands up to him and stands by Carter and Sadie's side. And you can tell this is quite literally drawing a line in the sand, because he's like, don't do it. You don't want to mess with me. And she's like, I don't really have a choice because you are a crazy person.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, she stands by their side. And Amos defends them using what else but storm magic, chaos magic.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you feel about this? Because that was a big red flag.
I mean, huge red flag.
Yeah.
If it doesn't wave a giant red flag, have you seen the meme of the guy that runs with the red flag?
Yeah.
Like, I see him running across my vision right now, because it's like, yeah, you don't have anything to do with set, do you, Amos? Like, he just let you go. Like, no, clearly something is going on. I don't necessarily think it's nefarious on Amos's part. Mm-hmm. I think he is trying to be helpful to them, but at some point you have to accept that you don't know what you don't know, and if you are possibly causing more harm than good because of Set's possible influence over you, maybe removing yourself from the situation or something is better than, like, continuing to be like, I'm the one who can help you even though you don't know. Like, you right. just don't know. But yeah, it was definitely a giant red flag. Like, sir, you are using Set's power. Or something very, very similar to what Set is about to do in 12 hours time.
Yeah. And so it's a little dicey at first, and the kids run away. Amos kind of is willing to sacrifice himself to fight Desjardins and try to let them, you know, get a head start. And Zia ends up summoning a pillar of fire that burns through everything. It is the most powerful spell a Master of Fire can summon. It is impossible to defeat. It burns through metal. It burns through rock. Desjardins throws some water on it, which just evaporates into steam. And it will chase after him, because she sent it after him specifically, until it dissipates, which is going to be in 6 to 12 hours. Desjardins is not happy with her about this, no. clearly. And she immediately passes out after summoning it, leaving herself powerless in order to help them. So she just made a huge move on the chessboard against Desjardins and in alliance with the kids. So this was like...
Yeah. She's all in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
She's pushed all of her chips into the center of the pot and has said, we're going to see how this goes.
Yeah. And that was a very reckless thing for her to do. Which, to me, doesn't totally feel like, not that it's not her personality, but, like, I feel like she would not normally do that. This was, like, a big jump for her. This was a big risk she was taking. I feel like she's usually very controlled, and she doesn't really want to rock the boat too much, but also I think she has a huge sense of right and wrong, and she knows what Desjardins is doing is wrong.
Yeah. Very similar feelings.
Yes. Yeah. So, right before Desjardins flees, he summons... why? Because he hates them. He summons Sekhmet, and Carter looks terrified. This is bad, bad news.
The worst of the worst.
Yes. And the chapter ends there. And remember, Sekhmet is the one who Bass took over for.
Yes.
Fighting the giant snake.
Yes.
So, Sekhmet's scary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big scary.
Yeah. Big scary.
Huge.
So, favorite lines, favorite moments. What was your favorite line?
Mine was from Sadie, and it was about, she was kind of thinking back to Anubis. And she says, "Perhaps Anubis's appearance with me was just a trick to befuddle my brain. A trick that worked quite well." And it's just the quite that, like, it just makes you giggle. It's like, oh, Sadie.
Yeah.
She's thinking back and going, yeah, he was, yeah.
He was pretty cute.
He was pretty cute. I like that guy. I like that guy.
Mine was actually from Isis inside of Sadie's mind when she's talking about what Zia did, and it's the line I kind of already said, "In order to help you, she has left herself completely powerless," which for Zia, again, I feel like is not something that would come easy for her, allowing her safety to be in somebody else's hands, especially somebody she doesn't know that well.
Yeah.
Kind of a big deal. So I really loved that. It's a, yeah, she's all in at this point.
Yeah.
What was your favorite moment?
The fire pillar and Zia being a total badass. Yeah. It was a moment. And again, we had just kind of talked about, you know, do we think that Zia set them up? And we know she has kind of some torn allegiances right now because she wants to be, you know, loyal to the House of Life. She's dedicated her life to it. But at the same time, like, she sees what Carter and Sadie are doing and, like, she doesn't necessarily agree with Desjardins, and so she's in this battle, and, yeah, watching her, you know, hearing from Amos what, or was it from Amos? I'm pretty sure. What creating the fire pillar means, and like that it is the ultimate spell that she can use.
I think that might have been Isis.
Was it Isis?
Yeah,
okay. I couldn't remember
because he was still fighting Desjardins.
Yeah. Okay. But like, yeah, hearing that from Isis and like kind of understanding the gravity of what Xia just did, it really shows you where her cards are. Like it, mm-hmm. if anything, if they ever, you know, questioned her motives here, this pretty much sells it. Like, she's not, you don't come back from this and then go back to Desjardins and be like, so did you love it? Like,
yeah.
Did it work?
Yeah.
We got him to believe it, right? Like, no, this is her proving her loyalty to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so just a really cool moment.
He's gonna be so mad.
So mad.
Yeah. My favorite moment was the description of the Mexican food. I feel like Rick is taking a lot of time in this book, way more than he did in Percy Jackson, to kind of talk more about cultural things. And just the time he took to speak on Mexican food and like it being made fresh, and the fact that like she could just eat a tortilla with nothing on it. It was that good. Like, and then I love too when she eats the tamale and she's like, it's fine, I've had spicier curry than this, and Carter's over there dying. He's like,
yeah.
I need water. That was really, really funny, and I loved it.
I was gonna say, I could definitely relate to her like being absolutely obsessed with the tortillas.
Mm.
Because like, girl, when you're hungry, there's nothing better than bread. And like, I could totally see it. Like, they've been running around like, you know, chaos agents for a while and
yeah.
haven't really had a chance to like have any really good food. So like someone just handing you like a freshly made hot tortilla, I'm sure it was like absolute heaven.
I feel like Chaos Agents has a different context with this book.
It does a little bit.
Because, you know, that could be, Amos could be a chaos agent.
There are actual chaos agents.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so those were our two chapters. I feel like they moved pretty fast. We got some information. We got some action. Plotting, so...
Yeah, and the second chapter was a little long, but, like,
mm.
it just flew right by
yeah.
with everything going on. So, just all that action
yeah.
keeps things moving.
And, you know, with 12 hours left, we are coming in hot to
yes.
the end of this book, and I'm very, very excited for it.
Very close. Yep, definitely. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Instagram at Prophecy Radio Podcast or email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us and our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews help others to find us, and we really appreciate them. You can leave us questions, comments, or ideas for episodes or content you want to hear in either of those two places. We have one bit of feedback. I just wanted to... It's been a million years since David sent us this message on Instagram. He was apologizing because my husband may have found out he was allergic to lobster while we were in Maine because we decided to try lobster. And David just said, I'm sorry to hear you didn't really enjoy them. I'm glad you enjoyed other parts of your trip. And I just thought it was very nice that
yeah.
he messaged. But also, my husband is now officially getting an allergy test.
Okay, good.
He,
yeah.
he had to go to the doctor this past week just for his regular like checkup stuff. And he mentioned it to the doctor and he's like, definitely worth doing because shellfish allergies are no joke and they tend to get worse the more, like if this was your first interaction with lobster ever,
right,
the next one might be more severe, the one after that might be more severe, so he's like, it's probably
yeah.
good to get a quick baseline for where you're at and whether you are or are not allergic. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah, no, it was definitely an eye-opener. And yeah, but we enjoyed Maine a lot, and yeah, it's okay, we don't need lobster, it's all right. I'll leave it for all you New Englanders who love it so very much. Okay, so next time we will be reading and discussing chapters 33 and 34, more than likely, depending on Comic-Con and what we get. But we will be reading these chapters next, whether it's the very next episode or the one after that. So, yeah, you may get a special ep where we talk all about the big news, and hopefully there's all kinds of great big news. So
yeah.
We will see. But yeah. Until next time, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.